is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonatotum, episode 88. Hello, my friends. On this and every episode of Sonatotum, we talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and, of course, staying healthy and sane in the process. Who am I to be talking to you about such things? Well, I have been an independent publisher and author and creator for the better part of a quarter century or more, depending on how you count. And in my day job, I help other creators bring their creative endeavors to fruition, to market, and to an audience. As I like to say sometimes, it's not my first rodeo, but boy, the bulls and the horses, and sometimes even especially the clowns, they keep changing. So I try to approach this show from the perspective of an experienced beginner, and hopefully you can learn from what I learn, and hopefully you can learn from the guests I have on the show. Today's guest on Sonatotum is the historical fantasy romance author Celia Lake. As it says on her site, Celia Lake spends her days as a librarian in the Boston, Massachusetts metro area, and her nights and weekends at home, happily writing, reading, and researching. Born and raised in Massachusetts to British parents, she naturally embraced British spelling, classic mysteries, and the Oxford comma, good for her, before she learned there were any other options. There are no other options. You can find everything about Celia Lake at CeliaLake.com. That is, of course, CeliaLake.com. And of course, I'll have all the links in the show notes for this episode, Sonatotum episode 88, over there at mattselznick.com/sonatotum-088. This is a great conversation, chock full. Celia's a little bit of a fast talker, so she gets a lot of stuff in. And so settle in. I think you're going to find a lot of value here, as always. Here is my conversation with Celia Lake. Celia Lake, what do you create?
I write what I have started calling cozy historical fantasy romance. I have 21 things out as we're talking. I'm about to have something else out in a couple of weeks. That is a lot. I keep staring at the number and going, I was there for that, but I don't know how that happened. Mostly novels, a few novellas in that count. Most of them are set in the 1920s. I am very interested, it turns out, in the 1920s because of the amount of change in society. I'm very interested in disability history, and there's a ton of really interesting stuff going on in that period. I think that there's a moment after you go through something really challenging, and it could be weeks later, it could be months later, it could be years later, where you sort of stick your head up and you notice that the world exists again. And I'm really interested in that moment. I think there's a lot of those moments in the 1920s, and I think it's a really fantastic place for romances because you notice the world again and you notice people in the world and how do you relate to them. But I have been spreading out in both directions chronologically. So I currently have things out ranging from 1882 to, by the end of this year, 1940. I have a World War II series that I'm sort of deeply in the midst of, and I'll probably expand further from there. But, you know, that's the range right now. They take place in the magical community of Great Britain. There is a bunch of background world building involved in that. The non-magical community and the magical community do interact in various ways, but the magical community has a bunch of its own customs, has its own educational system, has its own stuff they care about. And I love playing with that sort of identity set of questions. And what does that look like? And what does a working community look like? I think that's the summary.
Fantastic. So 21 books, novels, novelettes, novellas, yeah. And so on. Over how long?
My first book came out in December of 2018. I started seriously trying to do this writing thing in the beginning of 2017. So there's like a year and a half of me figuring out, can I do this and turn out things on a schedule that works for me before I started publishing?
And I'm going to want to talk about that schedule and that discipline. First, though, the question I always like to ask, once we learn what it is you make, what it is you write, is why do you create? Why do you write?
I fundamentally, and I'm sure we will get into this in more detail, I have a bunch of chronic health stuff. A bunch of my friends have chronic health and disability stuff. And I really wanted to write stories where people like me and my friends got to do exciting stuff that mattered and got to have great lives and got to have romances. And many, many people in my life do have those things, but they're so underrepresented in fiction in terms of those things being a thing that everybody gets a chance at or should get a chance at. And then I simultaneously also really wanted to explore that particular historical period and what you can do with that. I'm a longtime fan of, you know, Golden Age of Mystery, Dorothy L. Sayers, Agatha Christie. Like, there's a lot of really chewy stuff going on there when it comes to how do we relate to people. Mm-hmm. And so that combination sort of got me really excited.
Why fiction in particular, though? I mean, that could have been channeled into nonfiction, into essays, into advocacy work. What was it about actually writing fiction?
So there's two things, one of which is my day job is as a research librarian dealing with special education and disabilities. And so I do plenty of that advocacy and allyship and making information available in the day job. And it's great. I love my day job. But it was not the thing I was going to continue to do on my own time. Like, I would like multiple things in my life, you know?
Of course. Sure.
And I certainly bring the things I learn at work into my writing. There are historical resources that I know about because of work that I'm going to go write a book about this. The thing about romance for me, as a, you know, teenager, as a college student, I tried writing fantasy novels and I couldn't get it to work. Like, I would get halfway through the book and it would be like, okay, this is awful. Or like, oh, this story is just not going anywhere. Like, all the things that you get when you're starting to try and write. Sure. And when I sat down to try and figure out romance, I sort of started with it because romance as a genre rewards putting out lots of books. Mm-hmm. It goes well with that. But there's something about writing romance for me that is, you're really refined about a particular period in the characters' lives. It's usually not a super long period. Most of my books are taking place over a couple of months. Right. There's a couple that are a week. There's a couple that are closer to a year. But on average, it's like 3 months. And you get this snapshot of what they care about right then. Which I find really interesting because those snapshots are all over the place. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, larger content in the world. And then you know exactly where you're going with the end of the book. Like, the end of the book is these two people get together and are happy.
Right.
Yeah. And it turns out that that's much easier for me to write towards than any other like plot arc I have tried writing. Like, I just know where we're going at the end of the book. They are together. The end, you know? Yeah. So that's sort of why the fiction like that, I could see arcs in stories. I could see contained stories that I thought I could tell well, and I seem to be doing okay with. So.
And you mentioned starting to write as a teenager and in college. What inspired you to begin creating stories, even in those early stages? It is sort of the fundamental question. Why do you create? What got you going when you began?
My father was a specialist in ancient Greek theater. So I grew up on that mythology, on those stories. And we would go out for a dog walk and he would tell me stories. And we would start with the Titans and Rhea and Kronos, and we would work our way through the Olympians, and we would work our way through the Iliad and the Odyssey. We would pause for Lovecraft and Dracula, and then we would cycle back, and it would take us like 6 months of dog walks on average. Like, so I got these stories, you know, over and over again in my childhood with him telling them off the cuff. Like, he was a brilliant teacher and a brilliant speaker, and I am nowhere near as good as he was. But I sort of grew up on like stories are a thing that we do.
Right. Yeah, that's fantastic. That's wonderful. Yeah. And getting the Iliad and the Odyssey in the original sort of spirit that they're meant to be communicated as oral storytelling. Yeah, that's perfect. I mean, I love my Robert Fagel's translation, but I would love, love, love to just go on a long walk and have somebody just tell me the whole thing.
Yeah, and to get it sort of like piece by piece, I think it taught me a lot about the pacing of a story and like, what parts do you highlight this time? One of the things I really took away from my father is, like, whenever I'm teaching, whenever I'm doing, I do historical tours for the campus where I work sometimes. And I'm always in that moment of like, what needs to come out right now in this conversation?
Yeah.
That is something that I got from my father very much.
That's great. So lessons of story structure were just ingrained in you from the beginning. And it kind of makes sense that you would gravitate toward a genre where story structure is very specific. So circling back a bit to the world building, you mentioned that there's some overlap between your magical society and your non-magical society. And this always strikes me when I encounter story worlds that have that demarcation, because I think in like a regular society, that just wouldn't probably happen unless it was some sort of prejudicial or, sort of deliberately intentional, we shall be forever separate kind of thing. Yeah. And oftentimes the too easy example comes to mind of Harry Potter, where everything is sort of interwoven, but there's definitely a class, a class hierarchy, and the magic people are a bit elitist when it comes to the non-magic people. How did you go about, especially since it seems like you're very interested in the way societies are put together and the way people work and things like that, from what I've gathered so far, how does it work? How much thought did you put into, the why of, okay, why is the overlap so slight? Was there a whole lot of background world building that led you to create this society? You tell me.
So there are multiple points that went into this. So from 2007 to 2015, I was in a 7-year long Harry Potter alternate universe fanfic project. The conceit of it was that everybody had magical journals, and what you were seeing of the events was what they were writing down in those journals to each other. So private messages, public messages, whole bunch of stuff. I learned a whole lot from that process. I also have all the thoughts ever about the Potterverse world building and the gaps in it. Mm-hmm. So like, there's a bunch of that in my head. And I had this chance to see how people thought about the world building who were not me, which I think is a really amazing gift. And it was a very collaborative process. So each of us were bringing things that we thought of and making them work out while keeping the existing Potterverse world building in mind. So there's all of that in the background. There is the fact that I was, as an undergrad major, a music and medieval Renaissance studies double major. So I have all of this historical background in my head. And the last part was there. I really wanted to explore that, like, what does it mean to be a magical community? But I really wanted it to work. So the first thing I did when I sat down to seriously think about the project was set up a demographic spreadsheet.
Nice.
So I figured out like how many people are in this community and what is the percentage roughly of like what are they doing for employment? Many of them in the 1920s are still farmers or doing fishing or doing agricultural work in some sense. Like how many of them are magically super powerful? How many of them are magically like not particularly powerful, but they've got some? Because I believe very strongly that there should be a continuum of that and that magical power is also not just pure power, but how well do you know how to use what you have? And there's a whole layer of things that go into that.
The talent skill mix. Yeah.
And so I came up with a number and I came up with a number by looking at the size of the Jewish community in the UK in that period, which is about 250,000 people. Like it's not huge. Yeah. I want to say it's something like 1%, but I might be off by that to all sorts of degrees. But I wanted something that could clearly sustain its own grocery system, its own, specialists in the community, its own educational system to some degree. Like that seemed like a number where I could go like, yes, that's a self-sustaining community doing its own thing. And from there, I sort of worked my way backwards to, okay, how did they get there? The answer is something that I have not yet fully laid out in canon, in text, in terms of what exactly happened. I now have a pretty good idea of what happened and how it happened. And I will probably write a series in the 1480s at some point. I'm slowly sneaking up on the idea in the background reading.
I can relate to that. Yeah.
Because there's a lot of, like, I know how much background reading I need to do it the way I want to do it. And there's a lot of reading there. But the deal is that anybody who has magic has to swear on a Gaius that will do nasty things if you try to break it, that they will not reveal magic to people who don't have it. So that is my like why the two pieces are separate. You can go hang out with people who aren't magical all you like. You can do magic that they won't notice is magic. You just can't do obvious stuff that is magic or tell them about it.
The question that springs to mind, well, among many, is normal people, normal, quote, normal people, recognize that magic exists, correct?
They recognize that magic existed.
Existed. Okay.
I'm hand waving a bunch of this here, but I am assuming that you have powerful magical beings. They can do a bunch of stuff to fuzz the memory in the ways that you need to fuzz it at that point. This is part of what I haven't written yet. So like the.
Yeah, I'm even just thinking of your canon present, you know, your 1920s, 30s. So is your magical command. We're going so deep in the weeds on this, but this is fun for me. So hopefully it'll be fun for somebody else. So your magical community with their own infrastructures and social structures and whatnot, very much like the Jewish community, like you mentioned, are there neighborhoods, you know, is there, I don't want to use the term ghetto, but are there neighborhoods that are specifically for that community? Or are they completely integrated? Okay. So, but that, I guess that's what I'm asking. What sets them apart without the rest of the world knowing that the reason they're set apart is because they're magical?
So there are places that are purely magical. There are a number of villages that are purely magical that if you aren't magical, you just don't know they're there, basically. Mm-hmm. And you just sort of, you just wander around the corner of that space, which is actually surprisingly easy. Like if you look at like people wandering around the English countryside, this is in fact surprisingly easy to do.
So it's not like there's a neighborhood in London, but rather there might be people in London who are magical, but nobody realizes it because they come from this other place.
Yeah. And there are neighborhoods, there are streets in London that are purely magical, but they are sort of the same way. Like you wouldn't ever turn down that street if you weren't magical.
Got it.
You might know that there's a street there, but you have no reason to go down that street.
So I like this because you've sort of solved the wizard problem or the Marvel mutant problem, which is if there are enough of these people around, the balance of power.
Yeah.
You know, so but you and I did something similar in my Sovereign era story world, which is very broadly in the mid 1980s, in the Marvel Comics parlance, an Omega level mutant emerges and says, hey, I'm not the only one. We declare ourselves to be basically sovereign, even though we don't have a place or, you know, we're scattered all over the world. But we will handle our shit. Leave us alone. And we'll leave you alone. And of course, you know, it's the middle of the 80s. So it's the peak of the Cold War. This guy who has been sort of in the shadows, living as a normal human, shows up and makes this announcement, and people are like, oh, it's that guy. We know him. He's the, like, you hear his name and you go, oh yeah, that guy, he does the stuff. But he shows up and, you know, holds this press conference on the lawn in Washington, D.C. And as proof turns the Washington Monument from white to black while he's floating above the cameras. Anyway, so immediately the balance of power shifts in Cold World 1980s. But similar to what you did, I made sure that number one, this population of metahumans, to use a shorthand, are like 1% of 1% of 1% of 1% of the population. And among them, he's the only guy with that kind of power. The like 60% of folks basically are spoon benders. You know what I mean? Like just parlor trick kind of stuff that might convenience their own lives, but they really, there just aren't enough of them at the right level of power to truly make a difference on a global scale, you know?
I talk about that. I mostly don't focus on them in my books because that's sort of not where the interesting adventure plot, puzzle plot stuff is. But like 50% of the population probably has enough magic to use a magical device like a stove or a keep cool box or whatever.
They have
enough power to fuel that. Like these are in fact advantages in that period. Like you will die less often, your cows will die less often, but they're not super life-changing, especially not super visible.
You mentioned one of the reasons that you write is to provide a voice and to advocate for the disability community and to explore the history of disability in that period and the opportunities that were emerging, I'm restating that correctly. Are your magical minority, are they your stand-ins for folks with disabilities? And well, first of all, is that accurate?
No. So when I am talking about disability, I am talking about, I have a character who is blind due to gas in the trenches. I have a character, I have multiple
actual
characters.
Gotcha. Okay.
Actual disabilities. Yeah. History gives you many opportunities for disability is sort of where we're at.
And that makes so much more sense. And I'm happy to hear it. Because again, that's sort of the wizard problem, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And also very much like magic helps with some of this stuff, but I do not want to do the magical cure thing like that. I want to stay far away from, but Giles, who is blind, uses stones with sympathetic magic to help him orient himself in the room. This is a tech that we have now, functionally. Like, you can do that with Bluetooth, you know, speaker stuff. He just uses magic, but he's still blind. Like, he does not have vision. He uses some what we would call assistive tech, but it's not changing the blindness.
The other question I wanted to touch upon, you were 21 books, and I know they're kind of going across time and you're going backwards and forwards in terms of the stories you're telling. Do you have in your head sort of an overall arc? Is there a mega story that you're telling?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. I turn out to be a person where I will sort of stick, like, I know that there's an event here, and the way that you talk around an event when it's a couple of years in the past where you're not getting super into the details. So in my second book, I have one of those things turn up, and that has now produced an arc that is ranging up into the final piece of the resolution of it will be 1944, early 1945. And it starts in 1917. Like, apparently that's a thing I do. I will hop all over my own timeline, but each, you know, different relationships, different situations will bring out different pieces of that information. So now I'm sort of looking at, there's a couple of series events like that where I do intend to go back and fill more details in.
That's the way I like to play as well. I mean, I don't have anything near 21 titles in my different story worlds, but yeah, there's a couple of things. I'm not going to claim to have coined this term, but basically you're creating a mosaic universe,
yes.
Right? It's piece by piece by piece. And you eventually, if you pull back far enough, it might form a complete picture, or at least enough of a picture for verisimilitude.
Yes.
And having little notes, you know, like, I know that this happened, don't know much about it, but it's had implications for centuries or decades, and it's something you can lean on and come back to, and they drive plot and spark ideas. Something else that it sounds like you do, I call story budding, where a secondary character might walk into a room in one book and say, oh, yeah, I just came back from blah, 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 blah. And then, oh, I can write a short story or a novella, or, you know, where yes, were they before they came into that room?
I do so much of that. And my readers have actually commented, like, I would write fanfic about this stuff, but I know that you're going to pick up that character again sometime.
You get to do your own fanfic. It's so fun.
Yeah, I do my own fanfic. I am fanfic friendly. Like, I am, like most authors, I'm like, legally, just don't tell me it exists. Like, but I'm totally fanfic friendly. And, you know, if people want to ask me, like, is this a canon thing? Can you tell me what the canon detail is here? I'm super happy to do that, because I have tons of notes, or like I don't know what that's doing yet, but I know that's going to be a thing, so you might, like, just so you know, the contents might shift in transit,
right?
But I just threw in a random meeting, being like, oh, these people are at the same party, let me introduce you. And then I'm like, and now I've got to find a romance for them, apparently. Like, I've got to find a place to put that book, because now I want to know what their story is. I only have two sentences of it, but boy, am I interested.
Right. So something, because I think very much in those terms as well, when I'm crafting stories and story worlds, something that I have, well, let's call it not back burner, maybe middle burner, probably back burner, is the idea of a personal creative franchise, like the Thieves World anthology or the you know, Wild Cards or things like that, where you open the playground and either give people some of those story buds to harvest, to cultivate, or allow people to bring their own stuff in. But it's all, you know, you're sort of coordinating it and making it part of the larger, you're having other folks help fill in those tiles on the mosaic, basically.
Yeah.
Because there's only so many years that we get to do this, you know?
Yeah.
And for myself, I mean, I'm 56, or I'm going to be 56 this year. And I think about sort of my average rate of production, the number of stories I know I want to tell, and the number of years. And I did the math one day. I'm like, I need to live to be 115, and I need to have my full capacities the entire time. You know,
and the chances of that are maybe not super high.
So great. I might have 20 years, maybe 30 if I'm really lucky, or I could be hit by a bus tomorrow. So is that something that you think about? I mean, not just as a creator, but also in terms of the business side of this, creating that sort of shared universe, personal franchise kind of thing.
I haven't thought about it in that context, but I do think about that, like, legacy and, you know, what happens if I have to stop for some reason.
Yeah.
I do a lot of collaboration. One of my best friends, Kia Nicol, is also an author themselves, but mostly short stories at this point. And we do tons of back and forth on the world building. They see a chapter as soon as I finish it. We do tons of, like, help me debug this thing I'm trying to figure out. I will get tons of comments of, so I woke up at 3 o'clock this morning and I was thinking about this bit, you know, in my email in the morning occasionally. Mm-hmm. So there is somebody else who is very much in my brain. And if something, you know, we do share a brain usually.
Yeah.
So if something happened to me, there would be, you know, not necessarily a way to continue it, but somebody who has most of that information and who knows where it lives on my computer, who could at least pick up the pieces and do something else with it, you know, or open it up to other people playing in it. I have a public wiki that I have been setting up that allows you to track the, like, this book takes place, this storyline takes place over, you know, 6 books and 30 years here. You know, let me trace that for you. So I have some public stuff. I have a much more extensive private set of files,
right,
that has a bunch of stuff that is spoilers or, you know, not yet in print or things I'm still thinking about. So, like, that is there. I haven't thought about expanding it, you know, to something like the Theos World, shared world stuff. I feel like I'm not quite at a stage where I'm ready to do that because I'm still laying out pieces of the world building on a large enough level.
Yeah.
That, like, I need to finish making some decisions about some stuff before other people could sort of lay their hands on it, mm-hmm, to that degree.
Right.
But the fanfic space, like, I'm totally up for the fanfic space. I'm totally up for fan art. I'm totally up for, you know, other kinds of responses to it. And that what I've seen of that so far has been lovely.
That's really great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. All of these things sort of overlap, but tell me, in as much as you've thought about it and to as much of a depth as you'd like to go into it, how you define success for yourself as a writer, as an author, and where do you think you are in relation to that so far?
So it turns out that success for me as an author is people rereading my books as comfort reading, which I know because I know they do it. And I know how happy it makes me that I write a book that not only stands up as a fun story in the moment, as an enjoyable moment in their reading, but that they come back to it because they want that feeling again. And that it helps them get through, you know, whatever. I've had enough emails from people now that it's like, this got me through a really tough week. Thank you. I'm like, that is the thing I was writing for. I didn't know how to articulate it before this. Now I do. Mm. I love my day job. I am not inclined to give up my day job. I don't want to be a full-time writer. And also, I think the world would be terrified if I put out too much more content. Like, I don't think I could expand the amount of content. I think I would just be sitting there, like, not doing anything for 6 hours a day. That would probably not be great for me. Mm. I have done a lot of things with Becca Syme and the Better Faster Academy. She uses Clifton Strengths in a writing context. And I've been doing a bunch of stuff with her and various other coaches there in the last couple of years. And one of the things that has really articulated for me is the way my particular brain works, which is what that strength stuff is trying to get at. I really do want to have multiple complicated threads in my life. And I really do want that bounce between my day job, which I love, but which asks specific things of me, and the writing. Like, I might like to go to a 4-day-a-week day job. Like, ideally, that would make my writing life a little easier, but not ditch the day job, which means that the income piece, like, I like the money I make from writing. I live in a high cost of living area. I'm single. I'm a librarian. Librarians are historically not paid super well.
Sure, sure.
So, like, the extra income is very nice. And there's some stuff I can do for myself that now that that's sort of steadied, but I don't need it to pay all my bills. That is less of a factor of, like, am I being successful in my own mind? The thing I'm trying this year, I'm marketing as an indie publisher, is, you know, always complicated. Like, nobody, oh, yes. I don't know anybody who actually feels confident that they're doing that part well.
Well, whatever we did a week ago doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Perpetually.
Yeah. So like my goal this year is to try some new stuff, see what I can figure out that feels good to me, that feels sustainable, that feels comfortable, but to figure out, can I find more readers who would like me if they knew I existed? Mm-hmm. Like most of my pickup has been somebody telling somebody else about my books, which is great. You can't buy that. That is the reaction I want to have, but I would like to have more of that if I can get it out in the world. But it's the rereading that gets me every time. Like somebody telling me that makes my week.
That's lovely. And the fact that you are, and I mean this in the most positive way possible, content with the day job. You love your day job and it fulfills a certain role and is fulfilling. That gives you a certain freedom, which does kind of, I did want to dovetail or circle back to the 21 titles in such a short, relatively short period of time. Talk a little bit, and I feel like this is part of the marketing and work stuff, habits and practices. I think it's all part of the find success and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your writing practice. I'm guessing there are some systems that you have put in place for yourself.
So when I started trying to figure this out, I looked at, like I said, Romance Rewards regular output and higher amounts of output than, say, science fiction and fantasy. Just the genre reader is looking for stuff more often in romance. And so I sat down and went, could I do a book every 3 months? And I picked 3 months because I'm a witch and pagan. And so my internal cycle processing runs on an every 3 month scale.
Sure. Right? Mm-hmm.
And so basically what I have figured out, and I tried this out for a year before I committed to putting anything out, I always have 4 things in process. Let me start with that.
Okay.
Which is weird. Like, I understand this is super weird.
It's not as weird as you might think. I hear similar things from folks. Yeah.
The way I do it, like, I have not found anybody who quite does it the way I do it. But like, I'm fine being weird. Like, I'll be upfront about that. But if, just saying to everybody else listening to this, if this is not how you do things, don't worry about that.
Because right.
I recognize that what I do is weird and it doesn't work for most people. So I always have a book that I'm thinking about. I always have a book that I'm currently writing. I have a book that is sitting and letting the back of my brain chew on it. And then I have a book that I'm editing. So I start a new thing in February, May, August, and November. So the rest of my weekend is finishing some editing and doing an outline for the next thing, because I'm a little behind on the outline part. I had to finish some background reading before I could do the outline. So I have this internal structure that works really well for me. And in particular, it gives me time to, like, I know when the next thing is coming out that I have to think about, so that when I start writing it, not only do I have an outline that's sort of a very concrete piece of it, but I also have 3 months of just sort of thinking about how that thing's going to go. And these days I have a pretty decent idea what I'm writing out through the end of 2024. Mm-hmm. So like, I know what the next like half dozen things on the coming down the pike are as well. And I mostly don't have files for them. I will occasionally, I keep a file in my private wiki that's future books, and I will just like throw sentences in there when I think of things.
Yeah.
But it's not super, like, I don't start a file in Scrivener. I don't do anything super fancy. Just, it's a bunch of sentences of like, and the scene might be nice, or like, these people, we want to do these people. So that's part of it. And then the other part is that I turn out to be really good at getting myself to sit down and write. And I write last thing at night, partly because I'm really not a morning person, and the day job means I have to be doing other stuff in the morning. I am not one of those people who can get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and write before work. That would be hell.
No, yeah.
I'm also really bad at like writing when I have to stop. So like the idea of having to stop at, you know, 7:30 so that I can get ready to swap over to work things would mean I would not do writing most of the time, because I'd be like, but I only have 20 minutes left. You know, I can't write another sentence, apparently.
Yeah, right. I can relate to that.
Where if I do it on the other end of the day, like, I should go to bed, but if I go to bed half an hour later one night because I'm in the middle of something and I haven't finished the chapter yet, like, I can do that. Like, I'm an adult. I can make that decision. Or I can decide that, no, we're done with words tonight. You know, I'm going to go to bed. So I go through my workday. These days I'm hybrid, so I'm in the office 2 or 3 days a week and I'm home the others. My word count like doubled when I stopped commuting early in the pandemic. And I've mostly held on to those gains. But that feels really like I now feel like I've got ease around the word count, where before that it was a little tighter on like, I have to make word count to make everything happen. But I finish work, I have dinner. The other thing in my life besides the witchy stuff and the writing and the work is I'm in 3 role-playing games with friends, mostly every Monday evening and some Tuesdays. So that's like, eat fast, write first, game after. But the other nights, it's like I will do writing admin stuff. I will do, you know, other project stuff that I'm sort of poking around in for an hour or two. And then around nine, I sit up, put on the playlist for the writing. I stare at the screen a little bit. You know, I fiddle with things and I will produce. These days, I'm comfortably over 2,000 words a day on average. There are days in which it's less than that. Mm-hmm. I occasionally have days that are substantially more than that, but usually I'm right around 2,000, 3,000. Which is a chapter for me. So that getting to that point has been really nice because now I'm just like, I will do a chapter tonight. That is what we're doing. Editing has been the challenge because I can't edit on a work day and do anything like substantial. I can do, let me check for typos. Let me run it through ProWriting 8, which is what I use to check typos and consistency stuff. Every so often, my brain will, medieval is actually a very common one for me because I was a medieval studies major and I've written it a whole lot in the American spelling.
Right.
And unless I'm super careful, I will do that and not flip it. Computers are really good at catching that thing, it turns out. So I use the computer for that. But any sort of substantial editing that I, you know, I have to think about and move pieces around in my head, like that has to be a day in which I'm not doing a whole lot else with my brain and I'm not working. So that's half my Saturdays and I keep every Sunday free. I have to really, really like you and it's got to be a really exceptional circumstance for me to see somebody on a Sunday and schedule anything. Because that way I get a chunk of like 5 hours in the afternoon where nobody, like I've had food. I don't need to eat food yet. I can just sit down and lose myself in the thing that I'm doing for, you know, 4 or 5 hours. And that's my editing time usually.
And that's so valuable. Do you live alone?
I do. I live with Kat, who is asleep on the other end of the couch, but she's usually not super demanding. I could not do this if I had kids.
Yeah, it can be a challenge, even in the most well-meaning arrangements, to capture that necessary solitude, unbroken solitude, yeah. and thinking space. So yeah, so it sounds like you've built a life that supports and sustains your writing.
Yes.
Briefly, just because of my own professional curiosity, you mentioned outlining. How deep do you go on your outlines?
Not super deep. I turn out to be a person where if I get too detailed, I don't want to write the book because like all the interesting parts have come out already. Like that was one of the things that got me when I was still trying to write fantasy. It was like, I must plot a thing. No, I don't want to write it now because I plotted it. Like, where's the fun? But I'm not entirely a pantser in that terminology. Because I'm writing romance and I'm almost always writing dual point of view, I need to know like whose head I'm in as the plot unfolds so that I can figure out like who has which bit of the plot and where can that come out. So I have to do that much outlining because otherwise things fall to pieces. And I basically alternate, although I usually start with 2 chapters from each just to sort of establish the voices a little better. And then it's somewhere in the book, there will usually be some place where I double up for each of them again and flip because of what's going on or where they are or where the plot is. I also will outline, so I will get 10 or 12 chapters into the book about a quarter of the way through and my brain will go, okay, now we need to stop. Now we know these people. Now we have to like think about it a little bit and catch up and I'll go write something else for 2 weeks. I always have extras handy. You know, I might just put together a slew of blog posts. I save those for days I can't really think about fiction mostly, but like there's a bunch of stuff that I can write and that I will enjoy writing and that will be words that are not the novel in the moment. And so I will take that pause and then I will usually come back, rejigger the outline a little bit now that I've got more of an idea of what we're doing. And then somewhere around chapter 25 to 30, I will like go, okay, now we need to rearrange the outline a little bit again. I do it in Scrivener. Every chapter has a, you know, has its own little subfile. And usually what's on the index card notes for that is like 2 sentences. Sometimes it's more if I've got a really specific thing I need to hit or there's like background research for something where I need to get the details right. Mostly it's just like, here's what 2 sentences of what happens in this chapter.
Since you work in Scrivener, do you have you built your own template? Because there are,
yes,
obviously there are, yeah, specifics, yeah, specific beats and structure for the romance form. I do the same thing. But it's more of a story architecture, just general tent poles and whatnot.
I don't do a ton of the romance beats. Like I do not have the like third act bleak moment. I do not like writing them. I sometimes enjoy reading them, but I do not like that arc in a plot when mm-hmm. I'm writing it. So my plots, like they are definitely romances. They have a romance thing, but it's usually the challenging point is usually something external in the plot. Not these people are not talking to each other for some reason, or they are in despair for some reason.
That's yeah. where the cozy historical fantasy part
yes.
gets in. Yeah.
Yes. Like they're always working. It's almost always they're working together for some reason. Like they're solving a thing. They're working on a thing. They are professionally both involved in the thing. Yeah. And so like that is the third act, like turning point where they suddenly realize things. And often they suddenly realize that they are in fact in love with each other. I tend towards slow burn, but it's something external to the plot, not internal to the relationship most of the time. That's the trigger for the rest of the book.
And that's interesting. I hear so often, even from outliners, that they don't like to outline too deeply because they feel that, you know, where's the fun in writing if I figured everything out? I don't know if I'm unusual in this, but the writing, I think of it all as writing. So what I call it is the manuscript draft phase, where I'm actually adding words to manuscript. By the time I've got there, I pretty much have everything down, outlined down to the beat level. And the fun for me in the writing, the manuscript writing, is the art of it. It's the paint on the walls. It's how do we arrange the furniture? It's you know, that kind of thing. The architecture and the structure is in place, and I understand all the characters. And I typically work in multiple POVs. My last full length, my last novel was there were 5 viewpoint characters, but that was a fantasy / noir caper hybrid, so it suited that. You know, the work in progress now is probably tops there'll be 3 viewpoint characters. But yeah, it's, I have a theory that everybody is a planner. It's just where the planning takes place. You know, there's no real argument between planner or pantser. Like you said, you kind of stop and think after you've gotten a little ways in and let the pieces sort of resettle, I guess. You know, I just tend to do all of that before the first word of the actual manuscript is typed. And for me, it works well because I end up not using word count to think, if you know what I mean, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, as you said earlier, what works for one person is going to work for anybody else. And clearly this is working for you.
Yeah. Like I hit on a thing really early on in trying stuff that just mm-hmm. worked, and we're just going to keep doing the thing that works.
And that's really the key, is figure out, you know, and I'm not sure how much deliberate thought you have put into it, but I give you all the points for building the creative writing life that you need, that works for you. And because that's, I think, slightly speaking for myself, but I think we can generalize and say that's one of the biggest challenges, is just taking in all of the advice and all the different ideas and you know, trying to slip in and out of comparison and, you know, picking and choosing and distilling it down to what works for you is fantastic, which leads to the third pillar that we like to talk about, which is staying healthy and sane in the process of building that creative life. I mean, you did talk a little bit about habits and ritual and systems and things that make all that work. Talk a little bit about the staying healthy and sane part. What do you do to maintain that balance, to maintain those systems and habits, however you want to define that?
So I'm going to start by saying part of the context of my own life is that I've got, I think we're up to 8 that currently actually bug me. Chronic health things, and a couple that I just sort of ignore because they don't particularly affect me. They're just there. I had a major health crash in 2009, 2010 after H1N1 and a bunch of autoimmune stuff also happening. And I had huge issues with both brain fog and with stamina for a long time. At its worst, I couldn't read for 5 minutes because I just could not get my brain to work. It would have been terrifying if I'd had more energy to be terrified at that point.
Right.
I was out of work for a year after that sort of hit. And I started writing nonfiction at that point in the sort of the pagan witchy space, because that was content I knew super well. It was in my head.
Yeah.
Like I didn't have to think about the content, but I literally rebuilt my brain's ability to put sentences together by writing a bunch of articles that are up on that website, which I do not connect to my writing life because like I want people of all backgrounds to read me. So I sort of rebuilt my brain. It very much felt like that at the time. And then I did a bunch of, you know, stuff with medical providers and a bunch of recovering, sort of. And about 2017, I'd got into the point where I was able to walk a reasonable distance again and not be exhausted afterwards. You know, I'd moved twice in that time. I'd done substantial, like multi-hundreds of miles moves twice in that time. I'd had 2 different jobs. So I sort of came into the writing very aware of the limits of my stamina and also refusing to let those be quite as limiting as they wanted to be. Like why not do the stuff that you're going to enjoy if it's going to hurt anyway? Like, there are limits to this. Like, there are, like, you can only go out so often. But
well, of course, but it's managing the pain instead of trying to defeat the pain. Yeah.
So like that has been a lot of my philosophy of like, how do I do more of the stuff that I really want to do? And when I was sort of kicking around and thinking about writing, and I was thinking about other forms of possible income, like writing was the one of like, I'm pretty sure I can do that sustainably, which is a weird thing to say about writing, but there we are. So it was sort of then like, how much of this can I do? Where is there time in my life? I have some stuff in my life I have to do every day. You know, I spend somewhere between half an hour and an hour most days, like doing stuff specifically because of health stuff that I need to do. I have to go for a walk every day, which I sort of resent quite a lot some days. But the entire system works better when I do it. So we go for a walk every day. We are in pandemic still. I am still super careful. I'm still not seeing people in person basically at all. My work has been great about it, but I am high risk for complications. And in particular, I'm terrified of the brain fog piece of that.
Oh, yes.
Because so much of my life is like my day job is my brain. My hobby is my brain. Like, I just need the brain to keep going and braining.
Yes.
And so I'm super careful of anything that might interfere with that. And I'm willing to give up quite a lot else in my life to make that continue to be the case. Cause I've been in the brain fog place. It was not fun. I did not like myself. Yeah. It was not a good time. So like, there's a bunch of that stuff. And then there's like, I live by myself. So on one hand, the cat does not make a whole lot of mess outside of, you know, the litter box, but she's also not a lot of help with chores. Right. And I've just started a cleaning service because like, how much of my life can I get back if I am not the one who has to do the cleaning, especially the cleaning I find super hard for physical reasons. And I like that. And I've not only gotten back several hours of cleaning time, but a lot of hours of feeling guilty because I'm not cleaning. So I feel like the money trade-off is actually in my favor there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's like that kind of thing. I think about that a lot. My friend and I talk a lot about opportunity food. So the stuff that you can eat when your body is just like, nothing is food today. So I keep a stash of that on hand. I cook twice a week, sort of batch cooking, so that I have things I can eat quickly on the nights that my time is tighter. Like that kind of thing I think about a lot. I simplified my clothing choices down a lot when I first got sick. So like that is a lot of how I do my sustainability. And recognizing the stuff like the walking that I sort of resent, but also it helps. So we're going to do it. And getting enough sleep has always been one.
So the thing that comes to mind, systems, regimens, very important for you on a necessity basis. I mean, it's keeping you healthy. It's keeping you active and, as you say, sustainable is, I think, the perfect phrase for that, or perfect word for that. Before your health crises, were you also similarly systematic, or was that something that you came to because you had to? And then how do you feel about that? Have you grown into it and appreciate it? Or is it still something that, you know, because I know it could go either way. You could be like, oh, you know, I wish I could just do whatever, both creatively and in terms of just the everyday life and the health maintenance stuff. Have you always been sort of a structured person, or did you grow into that?
I think I've always had the tendency to structure. I was a serious horseback rider when I was a teenager, and also, you know, lots of academics. And so that takes lots of planning and scheduling.
Sure.
And just like the arrangements. And then I got sick and my executive function completely disintegrated. And so I had been running all of that executive function structuring stuff on sort of pure instinct.
Yeah.
And then I couldn't.
Yeah.
And it took years for that to come back. I was coming down the escalator. I had met friends at Convergence in Minneapolis, one of the big SF conventions. Mm-hmm. And I'd come in to meet them at the hotel for dinner. And I have this very clear memory of coming down the escalator with one of them, turning around and saying, my executive function came back.
Wow.
And this was like a friend who would, you know, we talked to me all along. So like, he's like, oh, you know, like, that's great. I'm like, yeah, but like everything, like we were doing the, like, we need to go get the car to do this and you need to be back for a panel at, you know, 8. So we should go here for dinner. Like all of that sequencing just snapped into place again after not being there for, I think, 4 years at that point.
You must have fallen down.
Yes, pretty much.
Like, just, knocked you over. Yeah.
Wow. And I still have days where it doesn't work. I am these days pretty sure that there's something in the neurodivergence thing in my brain. I haven't bothered with diagnosis, but like there are times when the executive function just fails. And there are times when I have to tease it into functioning. But that's part of where the systems are. Like I reduce the number of choices that I'm making. Like I just know that at 9, I'm going to stop doing the other stuff and start writing. Like this is what we do, so that I reduce the decision tree.
Yeah, it's fortunate that you have that had that sort of ingrained and built in ahead of time. You had the training to deal with the rest of your life. You just maybe not the way you wanted to utilize it necessarily, but no, I think you have absolutely, I mean, I say it again, you've created a life for yourself that sounds like it's working personally and artistically and professionally. And that's not something, I would say that's not something most people have achieved, or if they have, it's I'm not saying there haven't been, I'm sure there have been sacrifices on many, many different levels, but I say it again, you get all the points. Good on you.
I was just going to say, like, the one piece that people have actually asked me about is, like, I am single and there is a part, like, I write romance, like, I write the relationships into the world I would sort of like to have. And I'm also very aware that, like, where would I put one in my life is a good question. And I'm sort of at, like, if I meet somebody with whom that seems plausible, like, we will figure that out then. Like, I could see some places I could move things around and make adjustments and it would be okay. And the writing would still work pretty well on the assumption that somebody that I wanted that relationship with would be willing to negotiate on those points.
And there's the rub.
I am simultaneously also pretty happy with my life. So it's like, if that never happens, you know, that's also okay. Like, I'm not miserable being single.
Right.
I'm really pretty content, but I'm also like that is the gap in my life that is staring me in the face all the time.
Nothing is ever perfect, right? I mean, I think that's just for striving personalities and perhaps for creative personalities, there's always going to be something else we want, whether it's something we want to explore, something we want to create, or something that, we make choices. I mean, it sounds like all of this has been hard fought for you, but as you say, you're content. And I think that's so much more important than happiness necessarily. Yeah. Happiness is something that happens when something makes you happy, but contentedness is, it's a life skill.
I practice it really hard all the time.
And it rewards, I believe. So if you could distill everything that you've learned and figured out and faced down to a maxim or a bumper sticker phrase that you could kind of, not an epitaph, but the thing that would be on your banner, what would that be? Is there something that you can distill it down to? Have you thought about this? And what would it be?
I'm trying to decide between two things. This is the tricky for me. One of them is about leaning into, and I'm going to say weird here, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I mean, like, lean into the thing that is unique, lean into the thing that is interesting in that way that sparks that. I keep thinking back to a conversation I had with Kier when I was writing Seven Sisters, which is relatively early in my writing. It's the seventh book I wrote. And the main character, the hero in that, is a classicist. And I talked about my background, like, there's a bunch of classic stuff in my head. And I do, in fact, read Latin and Greek very badly. But I was pulling back on that because I was like, does anybody else want to read this? And he's like, no, just like lean into it. Like, you are stuck. Lean into the weird, lean into the classics geek. Just do that. And the book unfolded. And ever since then, I have had that in my head of, like, just lean into that. When I get that moment of hesitation of, like, is this too much? Lean into that moment, because chances are good it's going to be right. The other part comes out of one of my role-playing games and is, in fact, the reverse of that, where my character is in a serious relationship for the first time. She's in her 40s. And her boyfriend they had this conversation where she's like, I'm going to mess up about this. Like, I have past relationships that I have bad habits from. I'm going to hurt you. Like, I don't feel good about this. And he's like, you're enough. Like, you don't need to change. And she just sort of stared at him for a very long time. But I have been thinking about that interchange ever since, of what does it mean to actually be enough and not need that moment of striving and not need that moment of, I'm not doing enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not. Like, what does it mean to be enough there? So simultaneously, lean into doing the thing more. And also, you are simultaneously enough. Not a great maxim. It's not short. It's not pithy.
No, but I think they're not contradictory. They're complementary. Yeah. Absolutely. You've said something that oftentimes comes up in these conversations a little earlier, and I want to be cognizant of our time, but I do want to touch on this, the unexpected lessons in our own writing that we didn't set out, you might have set out for a particular theme or a particular capital M message in something you write. And then months or years later, you realize, oh, that's what I was trying to tell myself when I was writing that thing. And it sounds like you had that moment with that book.
Yeah.
How often does that happen?
reasonably often for me, and I always love it when I do, and this is a great chance for a story I think you will appreciate on the creative front. So I mentioned I was a music major, among other things. I am mostly theory and composition focused, not performance focused. And I started writing the first book in the World War II series, which is Best Foot Forward. And it's two men, and they are in Vienna and Berlin in 1935. Mm-hmm. They're on what is eventually getting somebody out of Germany mission. Mm-hmm. And they are enemies to its complicated relationship. And they're still fairly early in this, you know, not sure what to do with each other. So like, what do they do when they're hanging around Vienna and like need to be out and visible and social, but not like they don't want to be, you know, sitting and having a deep conversation with each other either. You're in Vienna in 1935, you go to concerts, right? Mm-hmm. And I had a class at the tail end of my senior spring in college that completely broke my ability to listen to classical music. This is 1998. As a music major, it was a conducting class that professor tried to turn it into a repertoire class. We had to memorize a whole bunch of symphonies well enough we could identify them from 15 seconds of music anywhere in the piece.
Wow.
We had three Beethoven symphonies on each of three exams.
Oof.
It broke my brain in horrible ways. And I had basically, I kept Mozart, I kept bits of Bach, I kept pre-Baroque period music, early music. But everything else was really touchy for 20 years. And then these two characters start going to concerts. I'm like, really? You had to do that? Okay. And they keep going to concerts where I could find out what they listened to, because the Vienna Philharmonic has their concert programs back to the founding of the orchestra online. So I could say like it's April of 1935, what's playing.
Yeah. Which is great. I love that when that's available.
And so a few chapters later, I'm like, okay, now we just have a playlist. And so there is a playlist for that book of all of the music. And it's several hours of music. I think it's close to eight now. And it fixed my ability to listen to music, to listen to classical music. And that is the playlist I had on while I was writing that book. I would just flip back to the relevant pieces. Like, that book fixed a thing that had been broken in me for 20 years. I love the book, but I will love the book forever, especially for that.
Yeah, it's a gift. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this has also, just in general, been really great. I think that we've really touched on a lot of things. Some common threads are emerging as I speak to folks, which I expected, but also you've provided yet another unique perspective. And just like with writing as specifically as we can tends to have universal appeal. You know, I think, you know, while of course, you know, we've said, hey, this isn't going to work for everybody. These things are pick and choose and figure it out and add it grist for the mill. I think that hearing your experiences is going to resonate with a lot of people one way or the other. And I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much for being on Sonatotum.
It has been such a pleasure.
Hey there. If you've enjoyed this or any other episode of Sonatotum, here are three things you can do to help support the show. The first thing, if you haven't already, please subscribe for free to Sonatotum with Matthew Wayne Selznick wherever you get your podcasts. Whichever app or platform you use, find that subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Second thing, please just take a moment to rate and review Sonatotum, again, wherever you get your podcasts. Rating is quick and easy. 5 stars is very nice. Go ahead and give the show whatever you think the show deserves. If you have just a few minutes more, please let the world know why you enjoy the show, why other people should listen to it and subscribe, by writing a brief review in your own words. Subscribing, rating, and reviewing, that all costs you nothing but time, but they make a big difference for the show, because when people are looking for podcasts on the writing and creative life, Sonatotum is more likely to show up in search results if it has a high rating and some nice reviews. Finally, Sonatotum with Matthew Wayne Selznick is made available for free and has no advertising. But it does cost time, resources, and money to produce every single week. If you'd like to go the extra mile and you have the will and the means, I hope you'll consider becoming a patron to offset the cost associated with the show and my other creative endeavors. Not only will you be a member of the Multiversalists community of writers, readers, and creators, you'll receive special access, perks, and exclusive content, the least of which is the uncut, unproduced edition of every episode of Sonatotum. Also, get this, your first 7 days are free. After that free trial, it's just $5 per month.
visit mattselznick.com/b-a-patron to find out more and to start your free trial. That's it. If you do one or two or all three of those things, you'll really be helping the show, and more people like you will discover the Sonatotum mission of helping writers and other creators make stuff, find success, and stay healthy and sane in the process. Thank you. Well, thank you, gang, for sticking around after the interview, the conversation with Celia Lake, and through the interstitial. I'm so glad you're still here. As always, I would love your feedback, your comments, your thoughts on this conversation with Celia Lake. You can leave a comment in the show notes there at mattselznick.com/sonatotum-088, or, you know, just go to the homepage there at mattselznick.com. Scroll down until you see episode 88. If it's, not too long after this show has first posted, and you'll find it there, right? There's always ways. Leave a comment there, or even easier, you can just email me at matt@mattselznick.com, or you can send me a little voice message, maybe something you record on your phone, and email that to matt@mattselznick.com. I have a little bit of an announcement, but before that, I want to thank my multiversalists, my patrons. You heard all about the multiversalists in the interstitial just a few moments ago. These are folks who are supporting this podcast and my other creative endeavors for at least $5 a month. And our current multiversalist patrons are Chuck Anderson, Amy Bowen, J.C. Hutchins, and Ted Leonhardt. And you can join those fine folks for just $5 a month. Get the uncut, unedited edition of this podcast and a whole bunch of other stuff for just $5 a month or more. You can go to mattselznick.com/b-a-patron to find out more about all of that. Now, here's what's up, my friends. It's been a really busy month since I got back from the Nebula conference in the middle of May. It's been literally a month. Today is the 15th of June. I'm recording this, as I so often do, from the lush and lavish studios of MWS Media in Huntington Beach, California. As I mentioned, it's the 15th of June, 2023. In that month, other than messing around with some notes and doing some reacquainting time and whatnot, I haven't written a word of fiction. Not for lack of desire, but there's been a lot going on. I've got some transition happening with some of my clients, some projects coming to a natural close, some other things starting up. It's been busy. My personal life, my partner is getting ready for a medical procedure, nothing life-threatening or anything like that, but something very, very necessary and overdue. And so that, preparing for that has taken some time. And once it's happened, is going to take some time, helping her out with her recovery and whatnot. And this podcast, friends, putting out weekly episodes, every other week, I'm doing one of these interview episodes, and that can take anywhere from 10 to 12 or 13 hours to do, to produce. The other episodes, my solo episodes, usually around 6 to 8 hours to do from start to finish, all said and done. And I'm spending a lot of time on this podcast and no time at all on writing. Podcast is taking up pretty much all of my free time. Now, I love doing this podcast and I have no intention of quitting, but I think it's time to take a little step back. I think it's time to reprioritize, because it's a writing podcast. I'm a writer and I haven't been doing any writing. And there's only so much time in the day. There's only so much time to be alive. So, effective this episode, episode 88, I am going to a bi-weekly, every 2 weeks schedule on Sonatotum. And I'm just doing these interview episodes. going to put aside the solo episodes for a little while. If you're one of the Multiversalist patrons, I will provide you with regular updates on my creative writing life through our channels. And if you're not a patron, if you're not a Multiversalist, get on the mailing list. Go over there to mattselznick.com and join the community. Become part of the mailing list community for free. And I'll be putting updates there periodically. And of course, you can find me on the socials, mostly Twitter and Facebook. And those links are at mattselznick.com as well. I'm not going anywhere. Please, if you are subscribed to this podcast, stay subscribed. But we're going to focus primarily on interview episodes every 2 weeks instead of alternating between solo episodes and interview episodes every week. I need the space. I need the time to actually create. So I hope you understand. I hope you'll stick around. If you really want to, again, support the show and my creative endeavors and help ease the pressure in various ways, ease the burden, not burden. Again, I like doing this show. I don't want to say burden, but if you want to support all the effort that goes into creating Sonatotum, then again, I encourage you to become a Multiversalist. But there we are. I wanted to let you know. Thank you for listening all the way through to the end. And you're the best. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. I'll see you in 2 weeks. And take care.